C1M. Number 6A.
This whole problem of a question, should we only suffer for our sins, or is there any purpose in suffering for other people's sins, was the big question of the Israelites before and during the exile. Ezekiel, the prophet before the exile and his students during the exile, he pronounced that new principle that he said that each one is punished for his own sins and that no one can be punished for somebody else's sins. And so Ezekiel was telling the people that because Israel had sinned, they had to go to the exile. That's their punishment. And while they were in the exile, and while the Israelites saw the other nations and other people and their idolatry, their life, they felt, well, something is wrong about it, because these other people, they just go on, they don't care about anything which is right and wrong and morally right and so on. They live happy and joyfully and prosperously. And during the exile came the second Isaiah, I think you call it also Deutero Isaiah, the one who wrote the chapters 40 to the end of the book of Isaiah, and he came and preached something new. He went further than Ezekiel's principle of righteousness, which says those who sin must suffer, or because you suffer, it's a sign that you have sinned. And he went further, and he preached to the Israelites, to the Jews in Babylon, that Israel should suffer for the world's sin, and that Israel was chosen by Jehovah to show to the world that sin has no claim on them. And he was giving that picture of Israel as a suffering servant. You know, when you read that second part of Isaiah, you get there that vision of what the Christians take as a messianic vision of Jesus, which in the original language was meant to be Israel, which should be the suffering servant, and as I have heard in the original text, it's always written in the plural, so that it was really meant Israel and not just a single person like Jesus. That second Isaiah saw what Jesus afterwards fulfilled, and he expected Israel to see and to be that which Jesus afterwards was and did, namely that they should grow out of the fourth period into the fifth period, and that they should be willing to lay down the mortal sins of life and to exalt themselves to that point where they were willing to take on the sins of the world and show to the world that sin has no claim on them. Well, I feel that that's the mission of each one of us, that we can't stop at that very, very comfortable stage of using Christian signs and of what we know about truth just to go as far as principle and say, if I do right and be a good boy, then I shall be happy and then everything will go right. I think we must go further to that prophecy of 2 Isaiah, to that suffering servant, to what Jesus was then showing through his life and his crucifixion, that sin or evil or error is not something personal, but that it is a universal claim, and that we have to handle it as a universal claim. That we can't be satisfied with making errors personal and say, if I do not sin, then I shall be very happy. But where we have to press on and further to the recognition of life, truth and love, where we see the nothingness of sin anyway, of any form of sin, be it the sins of other nations, like the Jews in Babylon should have seen and worked out, or be it the sins of somebody else, or of a nation, or of a climate, or of a period, or of an age, or what it is. So, when we read Atonement and Eucharist, we always come across those passages which show that Jesus was willing to fulfill that mission which really the Jews should have been, as the chosen people, should have been fulfilling. Reading in Atonement and Eucharist, we always see that Jesus did what he did not for himself only, and mostly not even for himself, but for the world. That he wasn't so much interested, like Enoch or Elijah, in working out his salvation, but that he was interested in working out salvation as such. And in order to show salvation as such, and universal salvation, he also had to show the nothingness of the universal claims of evil. She says, Jesus' teaching and practice of truth involves such a sacrifice as makes us admit its principle to be more than principle, to be love. It wasn't just, his principle was not just mind. Namely, that point where we say, well, I have a principle which is mind, so I can heal myself through mind instead of through drugs. His principle was more than mind, and more than spirit, and more than soul and principle. It was love. So it makes us admit that his principle was love, because it involves such a sacrifice of himself for the whole, that he said, all right, the whole world can just throw anything at me, can do with me what it wants, can believe about me what it wants, can play any, how did John say, bag of tricks about me that it wants, can just do what it wants, I'm going to show its nothingness. So you will always see that it's always a question that his works were for the others. For instance, Mrs. Eddy says, Jesus bore our infirmities, he knew the error of mortal belief, and with his stripes we are healed. See, with his stripes we are healed. She says, the efficacy of the crucifixion lay in the practical affection and goodness it demonstrated for mankind. Or, she says, the final demonstration of the truth which Jesus taught and for which he was crucified opened a new era for the world. Or Jesus' deed was for the enlightenment of men. You see, Jesus' deed was for the enlightenment of men and for the salvation of the whole world from sin, sickness and death. That he did life's work aright, not only in justice to himself, but in mercy for mortals. His motive for his life work must have been love, because he always did it not for himself, but for the world, for showing the nothingness of any universal claim of sin and sickness and death and error and whatever it was. Jesus taught the way of life by demonstration that we may understand how this divine principle heals the sick. He worked for their guidance, that they might demonstrate this power. See, it's always, his work was always for them, See, and that's why I say, sooner or later, the way of life will push us into that same position of Jesus. Not in the exactly individual same position, but principally in that position where we go on to life and truth and love, where we have to take on us the belief of the world. Well, a practitioner does that. He takes on himself the belief of the patient. He takes it on his shoulder and works through it until it sees the nothingness of it. See, in some way, we all have to go that further than that merely righteousness where we only are concerned, what did I right, what did I wrong? Well, this, I want to close this question because nobody likes a subject of suffering too long. But it's certainly necessary to see through that whole claim in order that we don't hold that principle and go on in our way of life to life, truth, and love. Now, last time we started with the chapter on marriage. And so I want to recapitulate what we have done with you and what you were thinking in the last few weeks in order that we get the touch of this chapter. Now, how does the chapter marriage follow the chapter on atonement and Eucharist? And we could see that the chapter of atonement and Eucharist had these high demands of, and those big demands on us, to be one, to find our at-one-ment with God, and to sacrifice everything which stands in the way of this oneness with God. And we have seen that it was a chapter with big demands, such big demands that I always hear, be it here or in any other town, that the student says, but they are too big for me to fulfill at the moment. At the moment. And that is the keynote for the chapter on marriage, at the moment. Because we can see that there is a very big distance between that inward standpoint where we really, truly and honestly are, and that attainment which atonement and Eucharist presents us. And this big distance must be bridged over. And marriage really is that chapter which bridges it over, which builds that bridge which says, all right, you don't need to be there where you inwardly are not, but atonement and Eucharist has presented the demand. It has presented the aim to which we have to achieve. But now marriage will tell you that you have to start where you are and not where you aren't, and that there is a gentle step-by-step development in your human experience which helps you to reach this high goal. So, marriage, the chapter on marriage deals, so to say, with that transitional stage. It takes in, therefore, a time sense. Whenever you read that chapter, you always get the time sense, a sense of development, of growth. There are always sentences in there. Once it was so, today it's so, but until we reach this and this point, and so on. We always see there is a time sense in it. And so the chapter on marriage regulates really and gives the theory or the principle which is necessary for this transitional period. See, I think that the loving side of this chapter. That God is not so cruel that he says, well, there is only one absolute fact, namely that God and man is one. That's very true, but love says, well, but I can translate myself to any situation, to any condition, and as I know that mortals, that goodness is only in embryo, in mortals, as we have seen, only in embryo, I can't expect that they are already in fullness, one with God. So I give them a bridge. Love shows the principle which bridges over the beginning with the end. It bridges over that span where we humanly now are in consciousness. That's one point, and bridges it with that final statement where God and man is one. So it's a chapter which is absolutely unimportant for the absolutists. Those Christian scientists who are absolutists, they just can tear out of the book the whole chapter. But love is much kinder than an absolutist. Absolutists are cruel. Love comes and says, well, you are where you are. And if I'm loving to you, I take you where you are. I make the best of what you are and where you are, and I show you the way out. And marriage shows that ascending, practical way out of the human into the divine. It's all about the human footsteps, really. It is a transitory stage. You know right from the beginning how Mrs. Eddy says that marriage is temporal. That whole chapter deals with a transitionary stage. But it shows that one shouldn't go into extremes. The beginner in Christian Science always wants to go into the extremes, and he usually likes to go into the extremes of the absolute, where he says, everything is all right, nothing can touch me, I am the child of God, I am the image of God, and he is writing with his thoughts in the absolute. But in his human footsteps, he isn't. We have to be quite frank about it. He isn't. There is a way, and here the way is shown. It is that way which shows that we should not neglect the good in the human, but that we should culture the good in the human. But one has to be careful to see that it is also the chapter which shows that the good in the human can never be the ultimate and can never be our aim. Because that's the other extreme, that we think Christian Science is that mean and will be that principle which will help me to fulfill good humanhood. And that is the goal of it. Now the goal of it is not good humanhood. Good humanhood is only the transitionary stage. And the chapter on marriage shows that it must lead to a more spiritual adherence and to man's coexistence with God. So, in this way, I think I have quickly portrayed the mission of this chapter. Now, how does this chapter, how does it try to show how we can go the way in this transitional period until the spiritual creation is seen to be intact? And something springs into one's eyes once is that in this whole chapter, Mrs. Eddy never uses the term idea. But she uses always qualities, good, positive qualities on which she builds. She doesn't build on the term idea. And therefore, what we will find here is that the transitional stage, which has to be developed and cultured, is appealing to good qualities. And every subject in this chapter depicts different good, positive qualities which have the ability to bring us nearer, step by step, nearer and nearer to the spiritual. Now, I can't help, I always think it's loving. I always think it's loving. Because from experience I always can see that if one would show to the beginner spiritual qualities, spiritual ideas, that they are always abstract, intangible to their consciousness, that they are far away to their consciousness, and therefore that they are just hypothetical abstractions. But Mrs. Eddy leads us gently by making use of what is innate in any mortal as that little remnant of goodness in embryo. That little remnant of which the Bible talks and says that remnant will stay, that will not be destroyed, that out of that remnant will grow a new tree, out of that remnant will come out the Savior, and so on. Here in the chapter on marriage, she makes use of that spiritual remnant. They are the qualities. And those qualities are always used for, as we have seen in the scriptural note, they are always used to resurrect, to exalt mankind. She gives here the theory, so to say, or the principle of which qualities should be cultured in order to make our manhood, to make our humanhood really better, to improve our humanhood, to exalt our humanhood, to make that which is good and happy and joyful in our humanhood more permanent. So it's a very important stage, this third chapter. I feel most important stage, because after all, we have our 70 or 80 years in the human, and I would like to have it a bit nicer than other people. I would like to see it freer and happier and more joyful, and not wait until one day the spiritual ultimate is here. So let's go to the questions which we had. See, in question 3, which was showing this, of considering the statements in this chapter about marriage and matrimony. See, it shows at once, as you have seen, that marriage, that this chapter deals with the temporal, with the transitionary. That it is that chapter which will continue until the spiritual creation is discerned intact. Therefore, it's a chapter which will stay with us and stay with us and stay with us as we go on through the following chapters. It will stay with us until the spiritual creation is discerned intact, and we can prove it and live it and know it and are convinced of it. Until then, this chapter is an important stage in our mentality and an important factor in our whole makeup. And only the last chapter on the Apocalypse really touches again the chapter, the question of marriage. From now on, how do you say that? From now on, yes. She doesn't use the term marriage anymore until page 575 in Apocalypse, where she speaks about the marriage feast, where love is wedded to its own idea. See, there. That's the real marriage. where love is wedded to its own idea. But until then, she says, marriage will continue. Our wedding with qualities will go on and will have its use and will have its positive, constructive effect. She says that marriage is a provision for the generation among humankind. See, it brings heaven down to earth, as she says in the New Birth. It is that chapter which shows how we can improve the human species. Now, that applies not only to the creation of new mortals, but it also applies how we, each one of us, can be an improving factor in the world, in our surroundings, because we are wedded to the whole world. Our marriage is the marriage within the whole world, and what applies to a husband and wife applies to each one in relation to each other one. It's the same marriage or wedding that goes on. And so we will find in this chapter the main point, namely how, through using the right positive qualities, we can be an improving factor in the world, how we contribute to the improvement of humanhood and humankind. She says that marriage is the union of hearts. She doesn't say, when she speaks about marriage, it's not just a legal marriage between a man and a woman. She says, no, her concept of marriage is much larger. It's the union of hearts. Well, whenever I feel united with somebody in my heart, I'm wedded to that one. And the more we base ourselves on science, the more we will be wedded to each other. She says it is spiritual unity. Marriage, therefore, her concept of marriage is whenever we find ourselves on a spiritual basis, where we unite on a spiritual basis, we feel wedded to each other, one with each other, one in accord with each other, and we are wedded to each other. And that is something which is individually true, which is collectively true, and which should be universally true. And so this chapter is a chapter which applies not if we are married or unmarried, if we are a widow or not, or a bachelor. Doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with that legal state, uniquely with the legal state of being married. It is a wedding to affection. So the whole chapter goes a sense that to what we should be wedded to are pure affection. And that if that wedding is present and is cultured and is used and practiced, that this wedding with pure affection has an improving effect on me, on you, on the world, and therefore brings out a higher sense of manhood. So, this is, in a few words, the question 3. And let's go to the question 4, where we consider the scriptural note. I always love the scriptural note in these chapters. You know, the scriptural note, they tell us, in a few words, the whole story, the whole pith of the story. And the scriptural note, the tone of the scriptural note, should really never leave us. While we study the whole chapter, the scriptural notes really should never leave us. They are the keynote. That keynote recurs and recurs and recurs through every paragraph and through every page. What does the keynote say? It says, what therefore God has joined together, let not men put asunder. We get a sense of principle. That is only united, that is only a wedding, that is only a marriage which God has put together. Well, God never has put together a man and a woman before the notary. Where are you going to be wedded? The notary or the civil, well, civil servant? Well, he never did that. He never did that. God always joins together qualities, pure qualities. That's the wedding. Then, that's principle. Then comes life. In the resurrection. See, we get the sense of exaltation. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. We get the sense of life and truth, and this is really the main tone of it, just as John Dole is, through his spiritual sense, has seen that, that the word as Christianity can be depicted as life and truth. Shows that moment we don't put asunder what has been wedded together. The moment we let our unity with spiritual qualities intact and we don't put them asunder, that has a divine effect. See, that's the wonder of the law of creation, which we humanly can't figure out, but which is a fact, namely, that it has always an exalting influence. That whenever one meets on pure spiritual qualities and practices pure spiritual qualities, that something lifts, that something in us feels exalted, lifted up, resurrected, improved, freer, higher, happier, it's exalted, and we feel as if we are a new man. We feel a higher sense of manhood. It has as its effect a higher sense of manhood. So let's always, these 2 days, I will repeat it and repeat it in all ways and means as it comes along in the text. You will always hear that tone. Let's just take that home for eternity. Well, I can tell you how Mrs. Eddy puts it in a nutshell in Miscellaneous Writings, where she speaks about marriage. She says about marriage, to be normal, marriage must be the union of the affections. See, we have the union that God has joined together, that principle. The union of affections, of pure affections, that tends to lift. See, she says, that has in itself a divine power. That's the law behind it, that it tends to lift. I don't know why it does it. Nobody knows why it does it. Because humanly one can't conceive of it. But the fact is that it does. That tends to lift mortals higher. See, can you see the tone of it? You have the principle, the union of the affections. You have life. That this union of affection has an ability to tend to lift higher. And it lifts higher what? Man lifts mortals higher. And we'll see how she varies from one subject to the other, this sense of exaltation and the sense of manhood. Now, in this question 4, I hope you have taken the time to go through it, because I always feel if one does these discoveries and this searching, it brings one into the rhythm of the thing. I don't believe that by just listening to the talks we get anywhere. I just don't believe it. I think it is prayer that brings us anywhere. And prayer is that inward desire, that consecration of thought, energy, and desire, which just has one big longing and says, I want to know God as He is, and I jolly well give everything I can to find out God as He is. And so I feel that we have to put some time and energy and love and into the search of this thing. Because, after all, Mrs. Eddy says, how is that exactly? She says that the one born of a woman, science must be a discovery. Well, I think we are all born of a woman. I think every one of us who is here is born of a woman. And for those, science must be a discovery. She doesn't say science must be listened to. And she doesn't say that science must be talked to. It's a discovery. We are in the age of science, and science, as its first claim, demands the sense of discovery. That we go out and discover. It's not the end and all of it, but the beginning of it. And so, I would love you to take time to go through these questions and go through the text and go through the text. And because when we do that, we wed ourselves to the text. We wed ourselves to these pure qualities which are in the text. And as Mary says, if we do that, they will not be in vain. That it has an effect. It will exalt us, improve us, and it will make us a better man. It has an effect. That loving, tender search and love for discovery lovingly goes through the text again and again with that always fresh and new inward desire to know being as it is, to know reality as it is, and not to be fooled any longer by what is not. If that desire is there, well, we have started right. Then we love that investigation, that discovery. And everyone will discover more things and more things.